Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're looking at a strange phenomenon in America, and it really calls for some explanation. Here's the deal. If you just look over the past half century, you'll notice that one of the most interesting demographic shifts is in the age of marriage. Young people are just waiting a lot longer to get married. That's the bottom line. You're talking about the age of first marriage shifting almost 8 years, almost a decade, going from about 20 to 28 for young men in this society. And that means that we are redefining manhood, we're redefining womanhood, we're redefining adulthood, we're redefining adolescence, and we are creating something new in this society. I'm going to argue that an awful lot of the pathologies we know in this society are traceable back to this one single fact. Young people are not growing up, getting married, and doing the things that adults traditionally do and have done. And that delay is creating an incredible burden upon the society, and it's changing the way we understand human lifespan. It's changing the way we understand expectations. Adolescence is now no longer, say, 12 to 17 or 18. It's now 11 to 28. Some actually argue into the early 30s. Let's talk today about what's really going on there. From a Christian perspective, we're going to be looking at a big article in USA Today this week that is documenting what the census data is showing us on this. We're going to be talking about what has happened, why it's happened, and why it matters. The phone number to join that conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. We want to invite your calls. We're going to be talking about this delay of marriage and what it says about what we have decided about marriage, what we decided about adulthood, what we decided about growing up. Interesting questions. Why has this happened? What does it mean? What do we do about it? The phone number again is 877-893-8255. Interesting developments in the news. One of the big things that just everyone's having to look at right now is the data coming in from the November 4th election. And, of course, we're kind of tired of hearing about some of the same old stuff, but there's some new stuff coming out. As you look state by state, you look at the analysis, what's happening is that the data is coming in richer form. We really have a lot more to look at. And here's one very interesting thing to look at. If you look at the vote in California for Proposition 8, that is for the proposition that allowed the citizens of California to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman, if you look at that data closely, here's what you're going to find. An awful lot of the people who voted for Barack Obama as president of the United States voted for Proposition 8. That is not what a lot of people expected. Because, after all, Senator Obama opposed Proposition 8, very publicly called upon the voters of California to vote down Proposition 8. He said that if he were elected president, and he has been elected president, that he would seek to even reverse the Defense of Marriage Act. But a lot of the people who voted for him voted for marriage. It shows you, at the first level, that Americans do not always connect issues. And we talked on this program about some of the data and research being done on the myth of the rational voter. An awful lot of people aren't connecting the dots. They like this, and they don't think about that. Here's another reality. If you look at the data, an awful lot of the data shows us that African-American voters voted down same-sex marriage. Now, you have an outrage building on that from some gay rights activists. James Kirklick, writing in USA Today, asked the question, where's the outrage? Blacks lifted California's anti-gay rights measure, he says. He says this, previously oppressed people, in this case African Americans, nonetheless voted for a measure that would, in his words, oppress others. Proposition 8's passage will result in the cruel revocation of a previously afforded rights from a minority. You start looking at this, here's the reality. If you are committed to the family as an institution, you're likely to be committed to the family for one of two reasons. First, you may be committed to the family simply because you believe that the family is God's gift to humanity, that marriage is God's gift to humanity, a part of his blessing to humanity in creation, and thus it is for our good and is to be embraced. Or, even if you're lacking that kind of worldview, it may be that you believe in marriage because you have seen the cost of seeing marriage destroyed and undermined and compromised. You see, I think an awful lot of African Americans have said, yes, we know what the family is. We know how important the family is. We know how important marriage is. It's not just a cultural conservatism that they are accused of reflecting here in this article. I think it is also a deep commitment that is reflected also in experience. So while you have many saying this is a disconnect, I'm not sure that it is in this case. I think it's probably more of a connect. Very interesting article that is out. You got to love this. When the New York Times writes an article on parenting and about paying kids to be good, well, it gets my attention. My parents didn't follow this kind of philosophy, but evidently it's spreading, at least in some parents in New York, among parenting circles. It says this. Lisa Belkin writes, saying that she might write a book sometime. She says this only half-jokingly, she says, that is entitled Raising Kids on Guilt and Bribery. She says it will be a surefire bestseller. Here's the deal. She says, I played the guilt card with my children, but not nearly as often or as successfully as they have played it on me. I've also stooped to bribery. More than once, I brought about silence in the car by promising a dollar to whoever didn't talk for the rest of the ride home. I've created elaborate charts over the years with stickers for each good deed, properly made bed, a day that passes without fighting your brother, and then I promised a proper reward. Most of the time, I lost track of the chart and gave in and got them the goodie just for trying. I have given $5 for an A, that is on a report card, and a cell phone upgrade for walking the dog for several months without complaining, and a stop at the deli on the way to school in exchange for getting dressed on time. Okay? It goes on and on. I think this tells us a lot about the equation of the family. It tells us a lot about how changes have come. My parents did not say to me, if you do this, we'll reward you. It was really kind of the opposite. If you don't do this, we'll unreward you. Now, the difference in this is not merely one of, say, a direction one direction and a direction the other. Here's the deal. It reflects who's in charge. If you are in a financial transaction, it is the customer who's in charge. The customer has the money. The one doing the sales wants the customer's money. Well, in this case, the child is in charge because the child's the one saying, I have what you want, which is my good behavior, and for you to get it, you're going to have to pay me. I think this is absolutely incredible. You know, when I read this, I have to say, this is the New York Times. This isn't the, say, the Birmingham News. This isn't the Jackson, Mississippi Clarion Ledger. I think it'd be harder to find this kind of argument, getting this kind of prominence in the media in certain parts of the country outside Manhattan. But evidently, at least in New York City, there are an awful lot of parents who are saying, look, I'll do what's necessary. I find that a very interesting development. I think you might as well. Lisa Belkin, writing in the New York Times in the Motherlode article, says, principles, schminciples, $14 a week is a cheap price to pay for peace and quiet. I think it's a very high price to pay for the child's soul. They're just learning all the wrong lessons there. Other interesting things, of course, are going on in the culture as we are watching. And one of the things also relates to parenting. You have an article in The New Yorker, another key instrument of the intellectual elite. The New Yorker magazine is the place where the most prestigious writers and authors want to show up. They want to have their byline in this magazine. Here is an article, The Child Trap, The Rise of Overparenting by Joan Ekesela. And what Joan is writing here is about children who are overparented by smothering parents, helicopter parents. This is how she begins her article. We've all been there, that is, in the living room of friends who invited us to dinner without mentioning that this would include a full evening performance by their four-year-old. He sings, he dances, he eats all the hors d'oeuvres. When you try to speak to his parents, he interrupts. Why should they talk to you about things he's not interested in when you could all be discussing how his hamster died? His parents seem to agree. They ask him to share his feelings about that event. You yawn. Who cares? Dinner is finally served, and the child is sent off to some unfortunate person in the kitchen. The house shakes with his screams. Dinner over, he returns, his sword point sharpened. His parents again ask him how he feels. It's 10 o'clock. Is he tired? No, he says. You, on the other hand, find yourself exhausted, and you make for the door, swearing never to have kids, or if you already did, never to visit your grandchildren. You'll just send checks. End quote. I find that a very interesting parallel piece to the part about paying your kids. You see, the problem of overparenting, as it's defined here, is that the parents think what they're supposed to do is make the child fulfilled. The problem is, that's not the job description for parents. If we think that it is our responsibility to make our children always happy, then we're going to have to ask them if they're happy. We're going to let them set the conditions for being happy and fulfilled, and we're going to find ourselves working for our children. That's exactly what's going on here. Both of these articles, both of them coming from New York, as a matter of fact, probably reveal a lot about parents all over this country. It's not just a power equation that is shifted with authority from the parents to the child. It is a child-centered culture that in the end, and I think here's the most important point, doesn't actually help children because it doesn't treat them as children, giving children what children actually need, which is direction and discipline, which is parenting and teaching, which is expectations set by the parents, not by the kids. We're going to be back to talk about the delay of marriage and what it means on the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. The statistics really do get your attention. You start looking at the census data and how things have changed, and it really is remarkable because we're looking at a shift in first marriage age from what was about 20 for men to now 28, what had been 19 to 20 for young women, now to 27. You're talking about an enormous jump in a relatively short amount of time. You're talking about less than 50 years here. You go back to the 1960s, the 1970s, you're looking at young marriage. You look at the situation now, you're looking at a lot of people, and of course that's the average. That means a lot of people are waiting even longer than that, and the Census Bureau tells us that this number is going up and up and up and up. A lot of studies being done about this and coming out now. The reality is that this is a huge shift. It has a lot to do, you'll hear from fertility experts, with the fertility crisis. It's because the peak age for fertility turns out to be when a lot of young people aren't married and having kids. Instead, they're waiting till older ages. And they're delaying not only, by the way, marriage, but once they're married, they're delaying children even further. So now you have a lot of the fertility problems in this country immediately traceable to the fact that people are trying to have babies later than people would have tried to have babies in previous generations. You're also looking at just an awful lot of redefinition of the human lifespan, where you have young people who, say, would have been married certainly by age 22 or 23 when they graduated from college, who now have a long period where they're not married, but they're really not fulfilling a lot of the responsibilities of adulthood either. An awful lot of them are now moving back with their parents. This is a very strange phenomenon. I don't know what you think about it and how Christians should think about it. I've got some thoughts to add to this mix. We'll be having this conversation. You are invited to call me at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Jill, listening on WFIA in Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Jill.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I disagree a bit. I don't think people are waiting by choice. I think they're just waiting because they're not meeting the right people at the right time.
Okay, you got to help me with that, Jill, because I want to hear what you're saying, but how is it that young people now aren't meeting people the way that evidently in the past they met them? That's what, in other words, what's changed?
You know, I honestly couldn't tell you, but, I mean, I didn't get married till I was 40, and I have a lot of really wonderful Christian girls at my church who are in their 30s, you know, who just are not meeting the right men. I don't know if it's the men aren't in the church. They're just not good Christians, not good Christian men out there to marry. I'm just not sure what the actual problem is, but I don't think it's a lack of desire.
You know, Jill, I think you're right, but I think you just kind of hit the issue there. You hit it with a glancing blow, so I'm going to come back and hit it hard. The data is pretty conclusive here that when you say there are an awful lot of people who desire to be married, you're absolutely right, and most of them are female. There are a lot of people who aren't doing what they ought to be doing in order to get married, and a lot of them are male. If you look at the data, it is very clear, and we as Christians have a particular understanding on this because of our understanding of what men should be called to do, how they should grow up and take this responsibility, how they should lead in a relationship. The fact is, an awful lot of them are living as boys well into their 20s and even their early 30s rather than growing up as men. And so I think it's very interesting the way Jill put that, because right before me I've got just, inches of data on this. And I've also got the experience of working with young adults. And I can just tell you that there are an awful lot of young men who want to get married in theory. There are an awful lot of young women who want to get married today. In other words, they understand their self-identity and their desires as to be a wife and a mother. They're just waiting for an awful lot of adolescent males around them to grow up. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Simpsonville, Kentucky. Dusty, what are you thinking?
Hi, Dr. Moeller. I'm, as a local church youth pastor, I've just noticed that there is such a huge pressure on students to attend college with the benefits of their parents paying them that in many cases there's a stipulation that they can only casually date and not be in serious relationships so they can get through college.
You know, Dusty, I think you're exactly right. I want you to play that out a little bit with me, if you will. Let me just ask you point blank. Let's say that a parent says to you, okay, what's the problem with that? What is the problem with that?
Well, I think there's a multiple problems. I think that we are, as a culture, dependent upon our parents for such a longer time than, like in my case, at 18 I had to move out and college was not nearly as much of an option because I had to pay for it myself. So as a parent, I would say that when do you want your kids to grow up, when they're 25 or when they're 18?
Dusty, I'm going to ask you a point-blank question. You're involved in youth ministry as a youth pastor. You work with young adults. I'm going to ask you a question, and it's the kind of question that you probably won't get asked very often this honestly. But I get to do it right here in front of a few million people, okay? Are these people not having sex? In other words, isn't there a problem here that this long period of delay between, say, puberty and marriage is opening up young people to an awful lot of sexual sin as well?
Absolutely. I mean, you see the rise of pornography and these kind of things. It makes it so difficult to get through those years. It's hard enough to focus on your education, let alone all the pressures around them. And I, to be honest with you, I don't know that I would have been able to stay as strong and as pure as I would if I waited till I was 28.
Yeah, I think it's a very honest statement, Dusty, and I'm with you. I got to tell you, I just don't think that's realistic. You got young bodies meant to be married and having babies. I mean, that's the bottom line. God made it that way. If you believe that humanity is a biological accident, then you can assume that this is just an accident of our evolutionary structure. If you believe that God made us, and he's telling us something, even in our bodies, what he starts telling young people when they're teenagers is, hey, you're meant to grow up, get married, and enjoy all the gifts of marriage. And delaying that is a huge problem. Dusty, your call is invaluable. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Chicago, Illinois. Adam's listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Adam.
Yes. Normally, Dr. Moore, I would agree with about 95% of everything you say, but on this issue, I just don't agree with you. And one of the texts that I'd like to bring up is how the Bible says in Genesis 2, it's not good for man to be alone. Well, in Genesis chapter 3, it goes on to say in the punishment of woman that her desire will be for her husband, he will rule over her. She was created to be a helper, and there seems to be a clash there. What I would argue is in Genesis 3:16, something has happened to marriage. It has been corrupted by her sin. And so, therefore, just as it is not good to be married, it is not good for man to be alone. The two are, therefore, parallel. And what I would say the problem is not that people aren't married, and I don't agree that adulthood equals marriage, but I would say that the real problem is sin, and the real problem is in verse 15 where it talks about about the seed of the woman. We need to have salvation from that sin, and I don't believe that we should look to marriage as a savior for our sin.
Well, who in the world would, Adam, but do you intend to be married?
Do I intend to be married? Yes, I do.
Okay, well, I thought I just heard you say that marriage is a bad thing.
Well, marriage itself isn't a bad thing. It's the sin that has corrupted it, that has come into the world, that is a bad thing.
Okay, I got to admit, I got no idea where you're going with this, because the whole topic is the problem of the delay of marriage. No one is suggesting that marriage is salvific. I am suggesting there's a part of God's command. And I'm going to suggest you have a very eccentric reading of Genesis 2 and Genesis 3, because there's a whole lot of the Bible that follows after that, which has a very different understanding of marriage, Adam, than I think what you're pointing to. There is an expectation throughout the entirety of the scripture that adulthood equals marriage. There is an entire expectation that unless you're given the gift of celibacy, when you say you're going to bring up a text, I was all hot for you to go to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 because I figured that's where you were going. But that makes very clear that unless you're given the gift of celibacy for gospel service, the expectation is you get married and you fulfill, well, just exactly what Paul's talking about in Ephesians 5, Colossians 3. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. We're talking about the delay of marriage. Interesting new statistics coming out. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We need to be talking about this, thinking about this in biblical and Christian terms. I appreciate Adam's call. Adam said he agreed with me on about 95% of things most of the time, but on this one he disagreed with me. 95% is a pretty good ratio. I like that. But it may be that I didn't understand what he was telling me there, too. And so, Adam, write me. Let me know what you're thinking here. I tried to follow the argument. Not sure that I did, but I'd love to continue the conversation. Here's my deal on this. I have served in ministry for a long time now. I am old enough to have children who are... looking at marriage in terms of something not on the far, far horizon, but something fairly close. I have worked with young men for a very long time, and I've been one. And the reality is that almost all of the young men I know who get married will tell me my life is not only healthier, but holier now that I'm married. I see the fruit of it in their lives, and I think there's a good biblical reason for this, because I think there's something that is called out of a man when he becomes a husband that is really essential to the formation of a healthy male character. Now, are there exceptions to that? You bet. You bet. The Bible's filled with exceptions to that. But the exceptions are for a purpose. And exceptions are talked about because they are exceptions. If they were the rule, they wouldn't be exceptions. They're exceptions because they show up because of this exceptional fact or facet. You think of the Apostle Paul. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the Apostle Paul says, I wish you were all as I am. And you know, there's a sense in which I understand exactly what he's talking about there, because I wish we were all so free of earthly responsibilities so that we could just be full-time deployed for gospel opportunities all the time. But if that's what God had commanded us to do, he would have said, okay, now this is the terminal generation for Christians. Don't marry anymore. Don't have children. Don't take on the responsibilities of marriage. Instead, all of you now go. Unencumbered by that. But that isn't what was said. As a matter of fact, we know that the disciples themselves, by and large, were married. We know that the leaders of the early church, by and large, were married. We come to know that when Paul is writing in 1 Corinthians 7, he's acknowledging the fact that the people to whom he's writing are, by and large, married, and he tells them, you be faithful in your marriage. And the expectation of the Christian church from the beginning until now is that most people will be married. And the issue there is showing the glory of God in that marriage, raising children according to the precepts of God's word, enjoying and receiving all the gifts of marriage, living out all the responsibilities of marriage. And so you have the household codes from the New Testament that say, here's what you do. Husbands, love your wife as Christ loved the church. Wives, be submissive to your husbands. You have the love. Children, obey your parents. Parents, do not vex your children. There's just a very clear understanding there. But there are those who are given the gift of celibacy, who are given a gift of being unmarried, such that they do not need marriage in order to be holy. They are given a gift, a compensating gift, and it is for a gospel purpose. See, here's the deal. It's not just an exception to be an exception. The Apostle Paul doesn't say, I wish you were as I am, because, quite frankly, it's an interesting lifestyle. He says, I wish you were as I am, because you could then be as free as I am to go for the gospel anywhere. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. What's going on here? Why did it happen? What do we say about it? Blaine is calling from Kentucky. You got it, Blaine. It's your turn.
Just a quick comment. I think you're probably right in that it's a lot harder these days for women to find men that are looking to be married. I think it's also difficult, though, in the confusion that there is regarding roles and genders. A lot of times, particularly for men that are in colleges and higher education, the group of people that they find themselves around, there are often not a lot of women who want to be married because they're seeking career, higher degrees. And not that that's necessarily bad in itself, but it can make it fairly difficult for men to find women who want to be wives.
You know, Blaine, that's a very important point, something very important to add to this. And it goes back to what was being discussed earlier, sometimes with parental expectations, too. There are an awful lot of parents. I've actually had a young couple come to me, wanted to get married, And the parents of the young woman said they wanted her to go on for a graduate degree simply because, quote, she's smart. Just think of what that insinuates. Too smart to be a wife and mother? You know, just get a graduate degree in order to have it so you can put it on the wall? You know, I had to scratch my head, and these are believing parents, but I don't think they're thinking like Christians. Here are two young people who say, we desire to be married, we desire each other, we need to be married. And they're saying, hey, there's always graduate school. You know, where are our priorities here? Phone number is 877-893-8255. And by the way, I'm president of a school with graduate students. I'm thankful they're here. But I want them holy more than I want them well-educated. We'll be right back with your calls.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. Let's go to Fairbury, Nebraska. Lemoyne's on the line, listening on KFRX. Lemoyne, my late father-in-law once lived in Fairbury, Nebraska. It's great to hear from you. What are you thinking?
Really? I'm thinking that possibly one of the reasons why we're seeing a delay in marriage is I'm observing so many young people are just living together. And then I'm thinking that maybe that is one of the reasons why we see reports that the divorce rate is decreasing, is because people aren't getting divorced because they never got married. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that they are having children.
You know, Lemoyne, you're onto something there, and it's a nationwide phenomenon. And by the way, I've got reams of data right in front of me on this. You know, let's just take this out of a Christian conversation for just a moment. Let's just assume we're anthropologists or sociologists looking at the data. Here's what you see. You see that teenagers are having sex at earlier ages than ever before. You see a hooking up culture whereby you have everything from oral sex to premarital sex to you name it going on, middle schools, high schools, college. You have a hooking up college culture that is just almost unspeakable in many places. On most secular campuses, it's pretty unbelievable by the self-reporting of the people involved, by health statistics and things like that. We're not talking about, you know, some conservative Christian trying to watch who's going where with whom. We're talking about people who say, here's what we do, and here's the here are the pills we take. Then you've got the cohabitation culture. You know, one of the interesting things, and I noted this in a very interesting moment, I was reading a report published by Harvard University Press on the family. It's a longitudinal study. And it just said something. It's one of those things that leaps out from the page and just kind of slaps you in the face. And it was an interview with a young couple in Scandinavia who were married. They were about 25, 26, and they were married. And they said, our best friends don't know we're married because it would be considered too weird. I mean, when you read that, you realize a whole world has changed there. You know, you have everything upside down. Lemoyne, you're exactly right. And, you know, the sex thing, just from a secular perspective, looking at this, the sex thing is very much a part of this, because if young men can't have access to females and sex without marriage, they're going to take it. I'm not talking about every single young man. I'm not talking about every single boy. I'm just talking about males in general. That's a Genesis 3 reality, and anyone who works with young people knows exactly what I'm talking about here. Now, let's put it back in a Christian context. We're Christians. We need to talk about this. Is there anything in this, in terms of this this question, that should lead us to wonder what are we doing in a culture like this to help our young people, our own children, our teenagers, our youth, our adolescents, our young adults, to figure out how can we maximize the glory of God at this stage in our lives? See, that's the real question. And that kind of goes back to what virtually everyone, I think, in this should be concerned about as Christians. How do we maximize the glory of God at every stage of life? And for most people, we don't believe that marrying 14-year-olds is going to maximize the glory of God. They're not ready for that. No one's pretending they're ready for that. Puberty does not equal marriage. Puberty equals pointer to marriage. But we do expect that at some point, this young man and this young woman are going to grow up and take up adult responsibilities. And adult responsibilities meaning establishing an independent household, taking care of one's own affairs, living on one's own funds, raising one's own children. together as a couple. But that's just not happening. It's being delayed. So what we have is we have a boy culture. You know, just look at entertainment. Just look at the statistics. I read to you on this program about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I think it was, an article from the manufacturers of video games who say, look, here's good news. Young men have more time to play video games than ever before. And it even documented the delay of marriage. Whereas most 25, 26-year-olds were married a few years ago, even a few decades ago, that is. Now, hey, they've got a lot of time on their hands. So sell them video games. Don't tell me there's not a problem there. Let's go to Long Island, New York. Krista is listening on XM170. Krista, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I'm wondering, what do you think is the definition of true love? And, you know, should people wait for true love to get married and play video games together?
Yeah, you know, that's cute, Krista. I appreciate the question. You know, here's the problem I have with many people who say to me, and I really respect your question, Krista. Many people come up to me and say, how am I going to know I've met the one and found true love? Well, you have to wonder what our expectations are. We live in a culture that is so shaped by a romantic ideal and so shaped by pornography. And I don't mean just illegal, obvious pornography, but I mean the pornography of false expectations. And that includes the airbrushed face on the beauty magazine you see at the grocery store. We have had our expectations so reshaped that you just have to wonder if anyone would really recognize true love or true beauty if they ever saw it. The reality is the scripture tells us that if we are a man, we're to marry a woman. It also tells us we're not to be unequally yoked, so that we should marry someone who's a fellow believer in Christ. We need to find out. Let's get back to the maximizing the glory of God. Who can I marry who will maximize the glory of God with me together? In our marital life, in our living together, in our receiving of the gifts and blessings of marriage, in our receiving of the gifts of children, if the Lord should give us children, and in raising them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, and in fulfilling all of this. You know, the reality is that most human beings, most Christians throughout history, haven't gotten married because they wanted to get married. They got married because, that is, to each other. They didn't pick each other out. This wasn't romantic companionate marriage. They were in arranged marriages, or they were in marriages that were practically arranged because of the very close setting of the social circuit. Most people have lived in a very tightly defined, you know, here's an interesting little factoid. You go back to the year 1905, Census Bureau data. The average person died without going more than 250 miles beyond the place he was born. Now, that's an interesting little factoid there. And an incredible number, you look at the percentage, something like 50% never went beyond 50 miles from the place they were born. Now, you look at that and you say, that's 1905? Well, you got a fairly small number of human beings you're going to meet 50 miles from your house, especially if you live, as many people then lived, in farms and in more rural areas. So it's amazing, Krista, that most people have had an easier time finding true love than evidently we're having now. And I think a lot of it is because we're expecting some kind of movement in the gizzard or something here, some kind of internal sign that's supposed to tell us this is true love. Yes, I would say, Krista, you don't marry without love. But, you know, true love is devoted love, covenant love, committed love. It isn't always the bells and whistles kind of love that means what you have is what the Hollywood magazines and movies and all the rest suggest you should have. I actually think that often comes later rather than earlier. And I think when it comes later, it's even better. When you get married and you discover, I love this woman more than I ever thought I ever could. More now than before we were married. I have now a knowledge of her that leads me to see things in her that make me love her all the more and all the more powerfully. I think there's real witness in that as well, Krista, to the goodness of marriage and to the goodness of God's gift in marriage. Thanks for your call. We'll be right back with Final Thoughts. Well, in one sense, it might be a downer to bring up the subject I'm going to bring up at this point. In a show, we're talking about the glory of marriage, because I got to bring up a man who is known, if anything, for his most inglorious marriage. And that is, we're talking about the 60th birthday of Charles, the Prince of Wales. He turned 60 today. Britain is recognizing this with celebrations. He now becomes the longest living almost monarch in British history. He has waited longer to ascend to the throne than any other heir apparent who actually succeeded to the throne in the entirety of the history of England and the British Empire. And here's the deal. It doesn't look like it's coming anytime soon. Given his mother's long lifeline, Elizabeth II, if she lives as long as her mother, will outreign the expected life term of her son, the Prince of Wales. Now, here's why I find this really interesting today. It's because the headlines in British newspapers talking about his birthday also bring up something else. Prince Charles is pressing for something that I've been talking about for a long time because he first mentioned this several years ago in an interview with the journalist Jonathan Dimbleby. He announced that he did not want to ascend to the throne as defender of the faith. Instead, he said, he wants to be defender of the faiths. Defender of all the faiths, because he says he does not want merely to defend Christian truth, but he wants to defend the truth in all religions. That's the way he put it. Well, it turns out that that will require parliamentary action and a constitutional change in Britain. Britain has an unwritten constitution except for anecdotal issues such as accession to the throne. And the official throne language now says defender of the faith. Well, negotiations are underway in anticipation of when Charles may rise to the throne in order that he may take the title Defender of Faith. It turns out that the negotiations have determined that Defender of the Faiths, with an S at the end of faith, is simply too problematic. But perhaps he can settle for Defender of Faith. In other words, just faith, whatever it is, whatever its object, whatever its form. You know, I find Prince Charles the absolutely modern paradigm of the postmodern prince. He's perfect. He doesn't believe that there is any particular object to faith. He just believes in faith. He's a very interesting character. He's a postmodernist in terms of his worldview. He has made this clear in his writings and in his comments, but perhaps never more clearly than when it comes down to this. He suggests that we should simply be universalists, and that Britain should no longer be known as a nation that is assigned to its heritage of Christian truth. Rather, he says, just defender of faith. You know, the amazing thing is, he really mirrors much of what's going on in British culture, and maybe his comments are more accurate when it comes to depicting Britain today. But it certainly tells us a lot about his worldview. That's our business. We'll be back next week to talk about issues for intelligent Christian conversation. I'll meet you then. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mohler Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.